Like steps with spring. The season of renewal and freshness. And the greening of nature. We here at IRIB English Radio wish you happiness, prosperity, and good health.
In the limelight.
The World Food Programme estimates that half of all Yemen's children under 5, about 2.3 million kids, are at risk of acute malnutrition, with 400,000 at risk of dying if they don't receive treatment, according to a spokesperson for the organization who asked not to be named because even the UN fears the consequences of criticizing Saudi Arabia. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Shoaib Al-Musawa, reporter. This article is titled, Pay Attention, Yemen Starves. Here's the story. Since 2015, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, backed by the United States, have waged a relentless war against their impoverished neighbor Yemen in a bid to reinstate the pro-Saudi government toppled by a popular uprising. The United Nations has described Yemen as the world's largest humanitarian catastrophe. The World Food Programme estimates that half of the country's children under 5, about 2.3 million kids, are at risk of acute malnutrition, with 400,000 at risk of dying if they don't receive treatment, according to a spokesperson for the organization who asked not to be named because even the UN fears the consequences of criticizing Saudi Arabia. Since President Barack Obama, successive American administrations have given Saudi Arabia crucial support to sustain its war in Yemen. Joe Biden promised to change that. On the campaign trail, he vowed to stop the conflict and end Donald Trump's blank check for Saudi Arabia's human rights abuses at home and abroad. This war has to end, Biden claimed in his first address as president. Noting that the conflict had created a humanitarian and strategic catastrophe, he pledged to halt all American support for offensive operations in Yemen, including relevant arms sales. Progressives welcomed the announcement, and the new administration basked in the glow of positive press coverage. However, just over a year later, Yemen's humanitarian crisis is worse, by many accounts, than when Trump was president. In the last year, Saudi Arabia tightened a devastating fuel blockade that Riyadh has long used as a war tactic. As Biden was entering the White House, commercial fuel imports to Yemen ground to a halt, with no fuel entering Yemen's Hodeidah port for 52 days. From January 20 to March 21, 2021, according to a report from UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. This is an alarming development, considering that more than half of Yemen's commercial fuel imports had been coming through Al-Hodeidah in recent years, the report noted, referring to the port, which is administered by the legitimate government in Sana'a and through which 70% of Yemen's imports enter the country. The agency called the shutoff a precedent not seen since the beginning of the conflict in 2015. Meanwhile, Biden's insistence on reaching a broader resolution to the conflict instead of first addressing the fuel shortage looks increasingly like a fig leaf for his administration's support for Saudi Arabia and its allies. shortly after he was appointed. Leonard King said that ending the blockade wouldn't work if done on its own, but only as part of a broader truce followed by negotiations between the warring parties, a much broader, complicated, and difficult task. Since December, the Saudi-led, U.S.-backed coalition has escalated air attacks on Yemen's capital after a long lull targeting residential areas and Sana'a International Airport, which is under the Ansarullah movement control, and destroying mechanics shops and key bridges. Another coalition strike landed near a detention facility for prisoners of war, which Saudi Arabia later misidentified as a drone manufacturing plant. Coalition strikes hit the airport's customs department, Yemen's Airways hangar, a COVID-19 quarantine building, and an aviation training institute. On January 18th, two Saudi strikes hit houses north of Sana'a, killing 14 and wounding 8, nearly half of whom were women and children. The attack came in apparent retaliation on UAE oil facilities and airports in Abu Dhabi and Dubai. On the night of January 21st in Sa'da province, coalitionary strikes struck a remand prison housing over 1,000 people, including African migrants, killing 91 and wounding 236. The UN and other aid groups denounced the attack and called for an investigation. Since March 2015, the Saudi coalition has targeted detention facilities across Yemen, killing 417 prisoners and wounding 484, according to the Legal Center for Rights and Development, a Sana'a-based rights group that documents coalition casualties and has identified weapons fragments from U.S. and British arms manufacturers. Among the dead detainees were 144 Saudi allied prisoners of war, most of whom had been defending Saudi Arabia's border areas with Yemen, according to LCRD data shared with The Intercept. The International Committee of the Red Cross noted that it had visited one of the prisons before it was targeted in a 2019 attack, meaning that the coalition was already aware of the facility's coordinates and should have avoided hitting it. Bruce Riddell, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, called the Saudi blockade of Yemen the most offensive action the Saudis engage in. The blockade is an act of war against the Yemeni people and is directly responsible for the massive humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen, especially the malnutrition of children, said Riddell, who served as a CIA analyst and an advisor on the West Asia region issues to four U.S. presidents until his retirement in 2006. Biden has broken his promise to make peace in Yemen a top priority, he said, adding that the blockade should be investigated as a war crime. The Saudis are bogged down in an expensive quagmire, Riddell told The Intercept, adding the Congress needs to step in and cut off all military assistance to Riyadh. Until that happens, more Yemenis will be pushed closer to famine. Acute malnutrition has increased by 284% among children and by 374% among pregnant women since October 2020, according to UN figures. Last month, the World Food Programme's Beasley was back in Yemen and noted that it is worse than anyone can possibly imagine. Yemen has come full circle since 2018, when he had to fight our way back from the brink of famine, but the risk today is more real than ever, he said at the end of a two-day visit to Sana'a, Aden, and Amran governorates. communique.
The war in Ukraine rages on. Despite a few rounds of peace talks here and there, there doesn't really seem to be an end in sight. During the last week, we've seen several major developments. Social media companies like YouTube have moved to ban Russian state-affiliated media such as RT and Sputnik, not just in Europe, but worldwide. There are now 2 million refugees that have fled Ukraine. You have foreign fighters, including Al-Qaeda fighters from northern Syria, from Idlib, that have begun pouring into Ukraine. And the Russians, even the Russians, have mounted their own volunteer force now. And in a bizarre twist of events, the U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, Victoria Nuland, admitted that the U.S. is funding biolabs in Ukraine. This is not a conspiracy. They're very real. However, she expressed concern about them falling into Russian hands. So what is happening exactly right now in Ukraine? What does all of this mass censorship mean for supposed free speech and democratic values in the West? Is Ukraine about to turn into another Afghanistan with foreign fighters flooding in left and right? And if there's nothing to hide in these US-funded biolabs, then why are American officials so worried about them falling into Russian hands? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. As of March 12th, 2022, the biggest Ukrainian cities, so the capital Kiev and Kharkiv, they remain under Ukrainian control. Now, Russian forces are just about 25 kilometers from the capital city, from Kiev. If you take a look at this map, then you'll be able to see the Russian forces highlighted in red. According to the United Nations, more than 2.5 million people have fled across borders. Poland has welcomed over 1.5 million Ukrainian refugees. Hungary, over 200,000. Slovakia, 180,000. And over 100,000 Ukrainians have found refuge in Russia. And so while people are fleeing Ukraine, there are people coming into Ukraine. And I don't just mean the Russians. You have 450 Arab and foreign extremists from Idlib that have just arrived in Ukraine. Almost 450 extremists from various nationalities arrived from Idlib to fight against Russian troops after leaving Syria and passing through Turkey. These are, of course, not just Syrians. They are mixed. They're foreign fighters, just like the situation in Syria itself. You have people coming from all over to join Al-Qaeda, to join its affiliates. The majority are from Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which is basically another way of saying Jabhat al-Nusra, which is another way of saying Al-Qaeda. It's Al-Qaeda. They just rebranded. They changed the name several times. It's still like Al-Qaeda. At the same time, you've had reports in the media that Russia is recruiting mercenaries. But this is not true. These guys that are coming from Idlib, they hate Russia because they've been fighting Russia in Syria, right? They're fighting against the Syrian government and the Russians. And so now they've decided to go to Ukraine to fight the Russians there again. Now, the reports that Russia is recruiting mercenaries, these are simply not true. What is true is that Russia has started a volunteer force. So not mercenaries who are paid, volunteers. You have to consider that Russia really turned the tide of the war in Syria. So people who are grateful to Russia for stopping Al-Qaeda, they're more than welcome to go fight in Ukraine. That's what Putin is saying, basically. Zelensky is the one who has Syrian mercenaries fighting on his side, who has Al-Qaeda fighting on his side. And those are the ones who don't care, who you are. They're extremists. And they'll kill Christians, they'll kill other Muslims. And the irony is that if you look at the Associated Press, what they're reporting about this Russian force, they're even telling you that the people going to fight on Russia's behalf as volunteers include Christian militias. This is, again, it's beginning to look a lot like Syria. It's beginning to look a lot like Afghanistan, where you have foreign fighters flooding in. And who's backing them? It's the West. Why? Just so they can antagonize Russia. They did it in Afghanistan to fight the Soviets. They did it in Syria to fight the Syrian government and the Russians. And now they're doing it again with neo-Nazis and Al-Qaeda inside of Ukraine. And so what's amazing to me is that No one wants to address the fact that these forces include neo-Nazis. The Azov Battalion is literally part of the Ukrainian National Guard. And just to give you an idea how they've normalized the presence of these Nazis in Ukraine, NATO, on their official Twitter account, they posted this tweet celebrating Women's Day and showing female forces. And this woman over here, turns out if you zoom in and you look at what she has on her chest, she's got a Nazi symbol. So this is called a Schwarze Sonne, meaning a black sun. And there you go. It's a Nazi symbol. And it's obviously not the only one we've seen in Ukraine. We've seen many more of that. And another example, the Foreign Ministry of Ukraine. They're also celebrating women in the Ukrainian army. And if you look at this photograph, you zoom in, there we go again, the black sun. So neo-Nazis are okay. Al-Qaeda's okay. NATO's okay. They're all fighting together. And this is totally fine to post on social media. And at the same time, while all of this has been happening, they've gone ahead and banned RT. So in the beginning, they were saying that, oh, we have to ban RT in Europe because the European Union, they demanded we do this legally. So on Twitter, on YouTube, on Facebook, everywhere, you can't access RT if you're in the EU. Well, that's not what's happened anymore, because YouTube now have said, you know what, let's just go and ban RT worldwide, not just in Europe, worldwide. At the same time, look what Facebook is doing on social media. So Facebook is now allowing hate speech against Russians. So you can go on Facebook or Instagram and say you want to kill Russians, you want to kill the Russian president. That's allowed. So they've made an exception on hate speech now just so you can call for the death of Russians. And it gets better. Are you ready? So it's not just about hate speech against Russians. They're even saying that Meta, which is Facebook, would allow praise of the right-wing Azov Battalion, which is normally prohibited. Who's the Azov Battalion? A neo-Nazi battalion. Here they say far, it's far right-wing. It's a neo-Nazi battalion. That's who they are. That's what they believe in. That's the symbols they wear. Okay? So they're basically telling you RT is poison. RT has to be banned. But if you want to kill Russians and you want to type that on Facebook, go ahead. And if you want to praise neo-Nazis, go ahead. Wow. And then they have the nerve to talk about state media. The censorship goes even further. Oliver Stone produced a movie called Ukraine on Fire, where he talks about the coup, the U.S. engineered coup in Ukraine back in 2014, the color revolution, the massacre in Maidan, the influence of NATO, the rise of far-right nationalism in Ukraine and Ukraine's history. And he made this movie with Igor Lopatonok. So he's the director, Igor Lopatonok. And their movie was banned. YouTube deleted their movie. Even though it's been online for years, they picked this moment for some reason, right when it's going viral and people are interested in Ukraine and watching this movie, they deleted it because it goes against the official narrative. The director of the film, Igor Lopatonok, is joining me now to talk more about this in detail. Igor, thanks so much for joining me and taking the time.
Thank you for inviting me.
Just the other day, YouTube deleted your film, Ukraine on Fire. Can you walk us through what happened, how you found out, what your initial reaction was?
A few days ago, YouTube just informed us that they taken down one of our copy on YouTube, what we post mostly for the people who has no access to Amazon, no access to Apple TV, to other outlets, just to let them see the film. It was heating up the last few days, growing exponentially because of Ukrainian crisis. And it was a 3,000 comments, like a 360,000 views. And YouTube step in and start censoring us. Thanks God. I tell it to Oliver. They discuss it with Glenn Greenwald, with whom we work on them during the Snowden time. And with help from Rumble, we penetrate that censor barrier. And now we have like a 500,000 views on Rumble and it's counted. I see that's first time. And I know what interesting happened next. Next, YouTube informed me that they adjusting the limitation on the film because of the law of showing criminal violent organization.
Right, so you have to sign in to confirm your age, right? They made it like a...
Not only, yeah, yes, this one. But after that, they take away, deleted, and movies reappear back on our channel.
I mean, the film has been up there for years. Why do you think they deleted it now at this moment?
I believe, first, we under direct hit from Ukrainian propaganda forces, military forces. They have a special division in Ukrainian military what operate the informational war. That's instructed, trained, and funded, and have big help from Department of Defense, of course. And they working under, they try to, you know what, they need to take down all other voices just to keep main narration, to brainwash the people, to let them believe is only one truth. And they're arranging, like, you know, polyphony of this so-called truth. So they're showing from different perspective here, different, but with same narrative. And this is what's happened to Ukrainian Fire. Yesterday, I post on the same day the tweet that got very big attention from my audience and others, because it was retweeted by the major the Twitter influencer, and I post the link on a Vimeo for download, not to watch, but download the movie and disseminate it everywhere. This is a very good tactic with you under threat of disappearance from the screens at all. That's got more than 2,000 downloads. So I'm happy that I know the Ukrainian Fire unstoppable now. And you know what's happened next? Vimeo take down that yesterday. Vimeo take down that link. Yes. Don't make any mistake. It's not only YouTube. It's like every mainstream big tech companies will be doing this.
And have you received other backlash or censorship over this film in the past? Is it the big tech companies, or were there other foreign governments also making a fuss about it?
The Ukrainian, the ambassador in Paris, to France, they send a letter to company TF1, to channel. It's a big company, and they requested, do not take the movie to the broadcasting because it's against the Ukrainian interest, and it's showing Ukraine in a wrong light.
So I mean, YouTube takes down your film, Vimeo is taking down the film. Do you feel that you're being specifically targeted in a censorship campaign? Is that accurate to say that?
Yes, I believe that we were specifically targeted because of our film, and the problem here, they make it too late. Because we're everywhere, they're everywhere, and they're gonna fail this attempt, because then more they're gonna censor in the film, then more people will be sharing this. So because it's like it's related, it's very much related.
But Igor, what specifically do you think they don't want audiences to see? Because you address a lot of things that you pack into this documentary. What do you think it is specifically?
First of all, they don't want to see that Ukraine filled with the neo-Nazi. They don't want to understand, they don't want the Western audience understand that something wrong with the mainstream media narration when they presenting Ukraine as a freedom fighters to fight with aggressive Russia. But if you study Ukrainian history for the last 100 years, and if you see what's happened in Ukraine after World War II, and to see my film, you will understand that's a bunch much complicated story, and it is not such a situation as a black and white, like a poor Ukraine who is a victim and the villain Putin who is attacking. No, it's much more complex. It's a civil war in the country. Country is very divided. Country is under, how to say, under not only influence but under direct influence, you know, direct ruling of people who sharing same ideology what Adolf Hitler disseminated in Europe 70 years ago. This what they don't want. They don't want exactly that. They want to present themselves as a innocent people who just want to join a Europe. And you know, it's no chance. And yesterday I listened to the Borrell, that's the executive in Europe who is in charge, you know, for the foreign policy of European Union. He said, we make a terrible mistake promising Ukraine and Georgia membership in NATO. Terrible mistake, because if we don't do that, that war never happened. So that conflict will never happen.
We've seen many of these stories, Snake Island, the ghost of Kiev. Many of these videos turned out to be from old military parades, video games like Arma 3. What do you make of all of this footage that's coming out of Ukraine, especially a lot of it being debunked in the first week or two?
Yeah, Ukraine has two special centers of psychological operation. This is a military division. When people in a uniform sitting in front of computers and producing this. The one of them was destroyed by Russian, the direct hit of a precise weapon in Kiev. Another one located in Lviv and still operational. That special forces was trained, established and trained by the specialists from Department of Defense of United States of America. And they skilled and much more skilled than Russians in producing of the needed narration. So the idea is, if you manipulate the media, if you can saturate the informational space with a different view but same narrative, and if you can suppress any other voices who giving the alternative vision, sooner or later everybody gonna believe in this.
What do you think the best solution is going forward? You mentioned Zelensky finding some sort of compromise with the Russians, settling on something with the Russians. What do you think the best path forward is?
I'm a filmmaker. I want to record the history for the future generation to understand. And it's a numerous solutions here, but if you listen carefully to the announced Russian goals, what they said, demilitarization, denazification, neutral and friendly status for Ukraine. Ukraine is independent, and acknowledging of the Crimea and the Donbas independence exist.
Do you think these are reasonable demands?
I think it's completely reasonable, because what the Ukraine is not a Zelensky. Ukraine is a country with a people with suffer a lot under this regime. Why? So I believe that regime change, what can happen any moment in the Ukraine by themselves, without Russian help, can change dramatically this way. So it's still a lot of fog of war, and it's still not clear path. But I believe somehow Ukraine will end up exactly in this solution. What's going to happen next? Europe will be not restoring their relationship with Russia. Russia changed the direction to East and it's Eurasia more and more now. So, and the West cutting off Russia out of everything, they more and more going in the shooting in the feet, because that will also affect the financial system and they'll affect, we will face a horrible year. So it will be a lot of fragmentation in the world. So I believe it's a new world order will be with the three different powers, United States, Russia, and China. It's a birth to this multipolar world is bloody, but I believe that new world will be much safer, because it will be no hegemony of one country on war ideology. And they will balance and they will watch each other and do not let each other to mess around.
Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
right up until a few days ago, U.S. biolabs in Ukraine was dismissed as a conspiracy theory. Here's an article from Foreign Policy magazine. They say, false claims of U.S. biowarfare labs in Ukraine grip QAnon. And then it turns out there's a Senate hearing, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And I want you to pay attention to this question that Marco Rubio asks.
Does Ukraine have chemical or biological weapons?
Ukraine has biological research facilities, which, in fact, we are now quite concerned Russian troops, Russian forces may be seeking to gain control of. So we are working with the Ukrainians on how they can prevent any of those research materials from falling into the hands of Russian forces should they approach.
So that conspiracy theory turned out to be true. And you have journalists like Diliana Gaitanjeva, who was on the show earlier, who were talking about this years ago, who are way ahead of the curve and exposing these bio labs in Ukraine. And so this turns out to be true. And people like Diliana were kicked out of the EU. They were shut down by U.S. officials. They were called crackpots. And now it turns out it's to be true. So if the U.S. is just doing, you know, normal, regular scientific and medical research, why is Victoria Nuland so afraid of these bio labs falling into Russian hands? In English, in the English language, when you say something is at risk of falling into the hands of the enemy or of someone else, that means you're talking about something dangerous, about a weapon, right? That's what it implies in the English language. The other consequence of the Ukraine war is the Iran nuclear deal, the talks in Vienna being put on hold. They were days away from signing this thing, from getting the U.S. back into the nuclear deal, lifting the sanctions on Iran. And then Russia all of a sudden asked for a written guarantee. Russia wants a written guarantee from the United States, at least at the level of Secretary of State, so Blinken, that if everything is fine with the nuclear deal and the sanctions are lifted, that Iran won't be punished with other sanctions just because it has economic ties with Russia, okay? And so the Americans are furious about this. They're also desperate to get the nuclear deal back into motion all of a sudden because they need Iranian oil to get back on the markets, on the global markets, so the price of crude comes down because it's at an all-time high now since 2008. And so that's one factor. The other factor that they're not telling you, because they only want to blame it on Russia, the other factor they're not telling you is that the Americans have continued to seize Iranian oil at sea. So this was published by the Associated Press on March 10th, and they say that U.S. seized Iran oil cargo as Biden considers easing sanctions. The United States still has the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, the IRGC, listed as a terrorist organization, which of course is part of their maximum pressure, their sanctions campaign, and it causes all types of problems in addition to the banking and oil sectors being targeted. So there are multiple issues now that need to be solved, but without a doubt, some people are calling the Iran nuclear deal the first diplomatic casualty of the Ukraine war. Does that mean that it's completely destroyed? No, but it definitely has been delayed. That's a fact. This is really desperate times for the U.S. The Americans are now running to the Venezuelans. They suddenly recognize Maduro. They say, please, please give us the oil. We will recognize you as president. And they want the Iranians, all of a sudden, they want to get back. The Americans want to get back in the nuclear deal so they can have Iranian oil. And they've been calling the Saudis and the Emiratis, guys, please help us produce more oil because they need the price of crude to go down. Because right now, with Russia and Ukraine, the price went up, gas and crude. And then when the U.S. banned Russian oil, it went up even further. So the Americans are in a very nasty position right now, and they're desperately trying to get oil from other places, not just because, you know, they need to replace their own 3%, which comes from Russia, but just for global prices to go down, because the sanctions have certainly influenced that. Again, we're really getting to see the true colors of neoliberalism. This is who neoliberals are. They love censorship. They love silencing dissent. This is what they believe in, and that's why they embrace authoritarianism and the deep state. And so, bottom line, you've got Al-Qaeda, neo-Nazis, and NATO all fighting on the same side. I mean, talk about an unholy alliance. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. Or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
The injustice of homelessness, a human rights crisis of immense proportions in the United States, is on stark display in Idaho's modestly sized capital of Bois, just as it is across the nation. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Tyler Valick, reporter. This article is published under the heading Occupy-style protest in Bois highlights brutal conditions faced by the unhoused in the U.S. Here's the story. The injustice of homelessness, a human rights crisis of immense proportions in the United States, is on stark display in Idaho's modestly sized capital of Bois, just as it is across the United States. While the city might not come to mind when one envisions the sprawling atrocity of homelessness, it is a 2018 court battle originating in Bois that has had a defining influence on homelessness policy far beyond the Idaho border. After passing ordinances that targeted the city's population of people experiencing homelessness, the city of Bois faced a court challenge from six unhoused plaintiffs. The outcome was Martin versus City of Bois, a landmark 2018 ruling by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals that barred the criminalization conducting life-sustaining activities on the street in the absence of alternative shelter. Although advocates had reason to cheer this apparent progress, the decision has ultimately served more as a reiteration of their moral claims than as a practical guarantor of the rights of the unhoused. Evasion of Martins versus Bois mandate has been the norm in cities within the court's broad remit. This is just as much the case in Bois itself, where the city has found numerous ways to violate the spirit, if not the letter, of the Ninth Circuit decision, perpetuating the kinds of criminalization, displacement, and harassment that are favored responses of power to the plight of marginalized people. In the frigid winter, the mistreatment of Bois' thousands of unhoused people has only intensified, according to activists. Housing remains scarce and unaffordable, while overcrowding and restrictions in shelters have kept many on the street in acute hardship. Local advocates, organizers with Bois Mutual Aid, and members of the unhoused have responded by joining together in coalition, spearheading an Occupy-style protest on the grounds of the Idaho State Capitol Mall. Now, over a month in, they have dealt with dismal conditions and repeated provocations from police and the far right alike. Bella Bounty, an organizer with Bois Mutual Aid, who asked to be identified by a pseudonym to avoid attention from the state and the far right, told reporters that in the last couple of years, activists observed something which has really escalated since Martin versus Bois. Constant police harassment. Tickets for offenses are handed out freely. Those unable to challenge their citations are often later arrested, held on failure to appear warrants. It's a punishing cycle that ensures their impoverishment. Police also profile and target people living in cars and order their vehicles to be ticketed and towed. Unable to pay the lot fees, many people lose their only shelter as a result. John Rogers, who has been on the streets in Bois since arriving from Louisiana in 2016, alleges systematic persecution in the legal system in the United States. They had come to arrest you, trump the charges up, make you pay an exorbitant amount of bail to get out. But when you go to court, guess what? They drop it. Or they drop it to a lesser offense, much lesser. So you're not gonna contest it. You're gonna take your lick, Rogers told reporters, adding, you can't do anything about it because now it's on your own record. They're just stealing your money. It's extortion. Members of the unhoused community in Bois are all too familiar with these kinds of torments. Teddy B is a veteran and one-time homeowner from Missouri who asked to be identified by his surname's initial. He has been unhoused in Bois for 2.5 years and has faced longer stints on the street in his past. He said bitterly, my experience with the police has been pure harassment. Almost daily they come down and confiscate sleeping bags, propane heaters, blankets, pillows. They have taken my dog's service vest. They have taken multiple sleeping bags. They took a whole backpack of the stuff. If I were to act the way the bar troopers and the state police of Idaho act when I was in the Marine Corps overseas, I would still be in the brig for it, he said, suggesting that he believed such behavior would have been landed him in military prison. Lone campers forced to hide from police face an increased risk of assault as well as hypothermia. In the winter, they must choose between the lethal cold and the very real dangers posed by heater fumes and tent fires. And community members allege when police come upon the unhoused people, they often relentlessly ransack their tents and confiscate all belongings, including cold weather gear, which in Idaho winter can have serious consequences. Search and seizure rights seem to be no deterrent, say local members of the unhoused. The reason they don't need a warrant is they call it a welfare check, Teddy B says, claiming that cops often attempt to check the welfare of the unoccupied tents, which they then throw in a dumpster. Then he alleges the Boer police sit and wait around the corner for nighttime for you to come to retrieve your stuff, and they charge you with a crime there. It's ridiculous. The system is designed to turn you into a criminal. Rogers described similar harassment, saying they have been known to take people's personal belongings and throw them in the street.
Aperture. Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the documentary, we went to Singapore, an island city state off southern Malaysia, where 5.2 million people call home. Singapore is a global financial center where one in four have a university degree and 90% own a home. By all counts, Singapore is prosperous, rich, and safe. But this is not the whole story. A 2010 survey shockingly revealed that over 9% of women in Singapore experience physical or sexual abuse from their partners, and one-third of these domestic violence victims have a college degree. We followed the stories of Rachel, Mira, and Vu as they shared their experiences of abuse, victimization, and shame. But as bad as violence and abuse is for any woman, and the situation is much worse for women who are migrants living in a foreign country, as we shall see in the rest of the program.
In 1994, Vu met and married her Singaporean husband in Ho Chi Minh City. She was 21 and he was 41. Shortly after, Vu and her husband returned to Vietnam so that her family could help look after the baby. This was when his true nature was exposed. Hoping for a better education for her daughter, Vu agreed to move back to Singapore. That was 15 years ago. Vu's husband's addiction to gambling often led to fights, but she learned to hit back. Although she could defend herself physically, he had other ways of punishing her. To remain in Singapore, Vu required a long-term social visit pass, which was renewed yearly. This visa requires a guarantor, her husband.
The law recognizes that when someone hurts you physically, threatens you, confines you, harasses you, then that's a violation of your rights. The law does not state that if when someone abuses you verbally, emotionally, that's a violation of your rights. And so protection under the law may not be extended to the individual under those circumstances. But does it make it right? Of course not.
For the first few years, Vu was financially dependent on her husband and mother-in-law, but she slowly worked her way to independence. To make ends meet, she sold donated clothes at the Sungai Road street market. For the past 4 years, Vu has held a stable job at a fast food restaurant. With help from charities and aid agencies, her children's education is paid for. She is the breadwinner now, but her husband still holds some of the cards. Vu wants to leave her husband, but first, she needs to make sure that her right to reside in Singapore is secure. In 2 years, Vu's daughter will be 21, the required age to become her mother's guarantor in Singapore. It's the promise of the life that comes after that keeps Vu going day by day. Whether or not her dream can become reality remains to be seen.
Some foreign spouses will find it difficult to get citizenship or PR because they don't have a lot of education and also a merit to men who themselves don't have a lot of education, lowly skilled, and they are seen as not being able to contribute that significantly to the Singapore economy. Because our immigration policy is very much tied to one's economic or potential economic contribution, the chances of getting the PR or citizenship are not so high. I think the immigration policy should definitely be reviewed. One, there should be some criteria so that foreign spouses can work towards making sure that in time they can actually acquire citizenship. Two, there should be some points given, you know, and a lot of points given for the fact that they have children in Singapore. And if the children are Singapore citizens, it really doesn't help the family that their mother has got such a uncertain citizenship status.
Victims of domestic violence transcend race, income, and educational background. One in three victims in Singapore have a university degree, and they are even more likely to stay silent.
There's a lot of victim blaming still going on, you know, and the very fact that people still think that, you know, I'm washing dirty linen, you know, in public when I talk about these things, you know.
Why have we still not come to a point in society where people are willing to intervene?
It's a private matter. It's between a husband and a wife. You should not interfere.
That domestic violence is a private matter.
We don't know all the facts. There's another side to the story.
I think the reason that that's so difficult, and I think you hit on two things that are really important that I think are sorely lacking right now in our society, which are one, empathy, and two, imagination. Mm-hmm. And in Singapore, these are two qualities that are not at all considered to be that important.
Once there were only two. Then it became four. Soon there will be six universities in Singapore. And more than 48% of university graduates are women. Both Rachel and Mira are professionals in the marketing industry. And like many other successful women, they have struggled with the issue of shame.
I didn't want people to know that, you know, I was like one of the statistics, you know, abused wife, and then, you know, the pity, and then, you know, the whispering, the gossiping and all that. I really didn't want any of that. So I very stupidly, you know, just kept it to myself. I didn't say anything. I just put it all upon myself, you know, to try to solve the problem.
I didn't want my family to feel that I've married a terrible person, nothing. I wanted him to be respected. I didn't want to go to my family and say, this is what my husband is doing to me.
According to the International Violence Against Women survey in 2010, almost one in three victims in Singapore have a degree or postgraduate credentials.
The fact that we found a disproportionately higher number of women who were victims of violence who had university or postgraduate qualifications hammers home the point that education alone is not enough. We have done well economically. We have done well in terms of, you know, earning capacity. But in terms of how we are as a society, our values, what we see as important, perhaps there's a lot more room for improvement.
Why did these professional women stay silent?
So educated women will feel that they should be able to handle anything that happens in their family, right, including violence. And so they are not going to readily tell another party. In fact, they often try to deal with it themselves, and they are less likely to tell their friend or family member because they're much more embarrassed.
It's not just got to do with the income and the education, but really a lot has got to do also with the beliefs that we hold.
Shame, embarrassment, saving the family honour.
Perhaps it has something to do with the fact that when I think about drawing attention to my problems, I draw attention to not just shaming me as a person, but shaming my family, my community.
But if victims remain silent, do family and friends have the responsibility to speak out? That is Robert's dilemma. He has known Luke and Lena for 30 years.
I actually did not believe that he would do such a thing. So when she told me about it, she said, I don't think I want to be with him. So I told her, well, give yourself a bit of time, think about it.
Robert never imagined that his friend could be a wife beater.
We always tell him, if you've got a good wife, then just, control yourself. Oh no, I love my wife. I love my wife very much. I will not do such a thing. But we can see, a few times when myself and my spouse met this couple, you could see on her face the black and blue marks hidden under the makeup.
When Robert accepted that his friend Luke was an abusive husband, he offered help.
I tried to help her by asking her if she needs any, advice from lawyers, if she needs to get away from him. We could help her find a place.
But fear has kept Lena under her own roof.
If she were to leave him, she thinks that she will lose whatever she's put into the home. And she may lose her son also.
Family violence professionals believe that the community has a larger role to play.
Violence will only stop if the society actually is more proactive, because it is really the people around the victim that have much more choices than the victim, much more choices to do something about the problem.
For most people, the hardest part is knowing when to take action and how far to go.
I have this fear factor in me that what happens in their home behind closed doors is very private. And the fear is, if I were to actually interfere in their private affairs, it may backfire. So either party has to make the first step.
Without an explicit cry for help, Robert feels he cannot act further.
If she comes to me physically and says, look, this is what has happened to me, with all the bruises and all the black and blue marks on her face or arms, I would personally think that I will bring her to a police station to make a report. But she has never at one time said, yes, help me, or I will follow your advice. So I'm in a very difficult position to report this matter to the authorities.
When is the right time to act?
There's something called the battered wife syndrome, and there are people who have been in victim mentality for many, many years, right? And the children see it, right? But are powerless, right? And so I think in some cases, you actually need to allow people like their children or even social workers to help them take that first step and to initiate the process, because otherwise they will continue to be in this situation.
Now that her son is about close to 30 years old, he's still single, she did bring this subject up to him and ask him that, she told him that one of these days I'm going to walk out of the house. I hope you will not blame me and you will support me. His answer to her regret was, this is a problem between you and Dad. Don't get me involved. It really broke her heart. And she said all this while she's been living in the home for the son. Yeah. And now with him saying this few words to her, she was really very disappointed.
So what do you think were Shuwei's beliefs, though?
At workshops run by advocacy groups like AWARE, gender stereotypes are being questioned.
You should be submissive.
I accept.
You should be a housewife.
You should be able to cook.
It's your job to look after the children.
You should keep the family together.
I accept.
Breadwinner.
I accept.
Macho.
You shouldn't cry.
I accept.
You're always right.
Whoa. I accept.
You are a role model.
I accept.
Without a shift in societal attitudes, responses to domestic abuse remain unchanged.
There are three typical responses when a